accession number 24623, reel 8.
Sergeant Newman, reel 6. Tell me about the farm. You're saying it was self-sufficient.
Yeah, very self-sufficient. They couldn't buy anything naturally, there was nothing to buy. But they grew everything they wanted on the farm. They made their own cider, made their own wine. But no such thing as coffee or anything like that. Couldn't buy it. They grew their own potatoes. They grew their own flours, like they did with the wheat and whites, as they called it. Ground it up and used it as a flour. Most of them had about 5 or 6 old cows, which they used for working. They even ploughed with them. Because I used to plough with them, but you plough at their speed. You know what an old cow's like, but it's
very slow.
But you want to learn to hurry it, otherwise there were no milk supply. They wasn't, so you just did it at their speed. And you plough with them and harrow with them. And then there's had the clover, because they use their buildings are built in a square. And in the centre is a massive great well. So all the sludge from the pigs, from the cows or whatever they got, all is drained into this well. Then they pump it out into tanks, wooden tanks on wheels. And 3 or 4 times a year, and they cut one crop and they soak it in this stuff, and they can get 3 crops a year of clover and all that sort of stuff. They can. They're wonderful people for improvising. Now, there was plenty to eat, because I killed the pigs for them. I did. My family had a brother who was a bit of a poacher. Shooting deer was illegal during the war, but he used to shoot them. There were plenty of deer around there in the woods. We used to carve them up and then soak them in brine. And they couldn't want anything about the milk. They had to supply the milk to a given spot way up in the mountains, some farmhouse. They had a separator. Ever seen a milk separator? We pour the milk in and wind it round, the cream comes out one end, buttermilk comes out the other. And all the milk had to go every morning to the separator. Well, that was my job. I said, there was a churn on my back with an harness on it. But they were only allowed 1/2 pound of butter a month, each family. All the rest went to the government. Well, as I was doing the milking, and I was doing the separating, and I knew when the inspectors was coming, because my girlfriend, Peppy, at the guest house, the inspector used to ring her up for accommodation. Now, she used to immediately tell me when he was coming. So I put my milk through after I'd skimmed it, took the cream off on it, and the old woman had one of them little things, and she used to make her own butter with it. But 2 days before he come, up to 2 days when he left, I used to leave the cream in it. So they never tumbled, there was no cream in all the rest on it for the year. We were still making butter out of it. Well, a bit very frightening experience for them. They used to say to me, what if they find out? I said, you don't know anything about it. I said, I've done it. Now, little things like that, you know. You've got to work it on them. Yeah.
I think you're saying that as the war was coming to an end, you tried to get away and go to Bosnia. What happened there?
When I saw how near the Russians was, I consulted my father, Sinclair, and his wife, and his daughter, and I told them I was going to disappear. Because the guard at the camp in Gerzdorf had had orders to immediately take all British prisoners back to Germany. Oh. Hostage system. So I decided that they wouldn't take any back. So of course I had to tell the old man about it, the old farmer or something. When they were very helpful. And even supplied me a hideout for so many days.
Where was that? Was it in the farm?
Yes, it was in the cellar actually. Mm. He divided the one part of the cellar off. And I lived in there, and he had a... There were some steps leading into the cellar, and he blanked it up, but he left an hole. And in the cellar I had a big round bowl, and he used to soup, send me soup through this tube, mm. down into my bowl. And then in the morning, there was only one little window ground level to this cellar, but I could get out of it, I could get through it. I used to shove my bowl out in the morning, and his wife used to come round feeding the chickens. She used to pick the bowl up, take it in and wash it, and then bring it back again. But then things got very dicey, because she come to me one day and she said, I don't know what I'm going to do. I said, why? Well, above where I was a spare bedroom. And she'd got five or six Nazi stormtroopers coming in to be billeted in there. On the retreat from Hungary, remember, I said. And she was frightened I might make a noise. You see? So I thought, well, it wasn't fair on her to put her to that amount of grief. So I told her straight, I said, I'm off. And she said, where are you going? I said, I'm not telling you, so you, if they interrogate you, you can't tell them. I was heading for Bosnia.
Why Bosnia?
Because that, the partisan was really strong in Bosnia. And I wanted to connect up with the partisans. And I nearly did too. I got shot though.
How did that happen?
Well, what happened is, if you escaped, the Germans, as soon as the Germans knew you'd escaped, 1 kilometre wide, they'd throw a screen of troops. And then they'd search it. And if they didn't find you in that one, they'd throw another screen at 2 kilometres wide. And hope to trap you somewhere in that screen. But I got wise to this, so I hung around till I thought the screens would be eliminated. They were gone. Which they did, really. So I got to this little village in Bosnia, just on the outskirts of Bosnia. And I was hungry. I was filthy. I'd been sleeping rough. And chiefly, I wanted something to eat. And I thought perhaps the Bosnians would be a little sympathetic towards me, you know. So I picked a very isolated farmhouse late at night and I knocked on the door. And they made me most welcome when I explained to them who I was. Fed me, gave me a bed for the night, and told me I could stay as long as I like. Which was very nice, I could have perhaps got away with that. But then somebody had tipped the police off, the Bosnian police, that I was at the house. And they came and arrested me, didn't they? Not the Germans, the Bosnian police.
How long had you been there?
About 3 days, three nights, something round about there. Actually, I was well established, I was helping them on the farm. During the day, because it was so isolated. I helped them milk the cows, I went out in the fields and mowed the old grass and clover and all that sort of thing. But I was spotted by somebody. So, they didn't actually arrest me. First of all, they said, you've got to move. I said, yes, okay, I'll move. I said, I'll go the next day. So they said, well, we don't want to know. Get going. But then I didn't know where to go. Because the deeper I got into Bosnia, the more dangerous it was, because it was occupied. And to make a contact with partisans is the worst job in the world. because you're under suspicion by everybody, aren't you? Didn't matter who I ask to try to make a contact. I was under suspicion. But I mean, I think the police got fed up. And they asked me to move out, and then they'd arrest me. Because they didn't want this
family
involved, you see. So I walked out in broad daylight. And I was just leaving the little old town, and they just arrested me.
What did they do with you when they picked you up?
Notifying the German authorities. Mm. And this is where the humorous part. I told you about the officer I had a drink with.
Yes.
Well, they decided to send me back to Gersdorf, where I came from. And it was there that I confronted this officer, who recognised me immediately. Now, he assumed that I was a French labour worker. And now I've been introduced to him as an escapee prisoner of English. And believe me, he wasn't very pleased. He couldn't hit me hard enough, kick me hard enough. I couldn't. But that was all right. Then they were going to shoot me. I think they got six of us, because all the blokes had gone as well. They caught all six of us, but one or two did get away completely. An old friend of mine got away, Matthews his name was. He was a hairdresser in London. He managed to stick it out, and the Russians released him. But they gave him a vehicle, an escort, and they told him that anybody had ill-treated them in the Austrian, in the villages or wherever they were, to take them out, show them to the Russians and shoot them. Which he didn't do, mind you. And that's when they were going to shoot us the next morning. They got five of us, I think, I can't remember. But I was, to cut the story short, they didn't shoot us, took us down to Peterhof, handed us over to the gendarmerie, who gave us one meal. Then the guards come, some old German guards come, those Russian front blokes, partly wounded and all that sort of business. Put us on the road, and I don't know how long later, we lived off the land again, travelling from Austria.
Just on foot?
Mm.
Moving on foot.
Always on foot. Mm. And we landed up at Salzburg. Oh. And from Salzburg they took us to another prison camp, which I can't remember the name of, a big one. And now the war was actually coming to an end. It was, I mean, our illegal radios was giving us all the news we wanted, and then Churchill and Eisenhower broadcast over the network, the Radio Berlin network, for all prisoners of war to remain at the post, don't leave the camps, as we'd be liberated in due course, and it was a dangerous world outside the camps, because, you know, we could lose our lives. So we sat tight. We hadn't got much food, but we had a bit. And nothing seemed to happen, and there was a railway line run just outside the camp. Now, all the guards, German guards, are getting very jittery. In fact, they're coming in the camp, giving themselves up to us, and giving us their arms. And we were posting guards outside of our own men to keep any Germans out that it was liable to come in and massacre us or something like that. And the train, about twice a day, there were trains running down this line, and it was crammed with retreating soldiers, German soldiers. So we decided we'd block the line. And we was armed, and we'd get these soldiers out, dump them, and then we were going to load ourselves up on the train and go to wherever the train went. We didn't know where to go to. So it worked all right. We blocked the line with everything, and this train come down, and We were just on the point of getting these German soldiers out, and the station had a glass roof. An atomic gun went off, blew in all the glass out of the roof. Of course, everybody turned around. I mean, there was 2,000 or 3,000 prisoners there. Everybody turned around, and the Yanks had arrived.
Oh. How'd they got there?
They'd come in by road. Mm. Yeah. They'd come and released us. And they could see what was going to happen, so they had to announce their presence, so they blew the station roof out. And shouted us to remain calm. They said, there's releases on the way, there's food coming. There's everything coming to you. So we didn't have to make the move of confiscating the train. The Yanks took it over, and, oh God, we never seen such food in our lives. They fed us so much we didn't know what to do with it.
Did anyone suffer from eating too much? Did you have people who went sick because they had ate too much too soon?
Oh yeah. Yeah, we had a lot of people suffer for it. And then I was coming around 3-4 times a day with lorries and throwing them sea rations. Mm. Every bell tent was getting sea rations, as many as you could put inside the tent. And in them sea rations was everything under the sun. From Yankee food. Of course, the blokes had never had it for years. Mm. They didn't. But we was trading it downtown. Oh. For toiletries, you know, razor blades, razors, soap. We'd never seen any soap for years. So we went downtown with his sea rations, and we traded with the population downtown. Cigarette papers. Anything that we had been deprived of all the while, you see. Plus a few women in the meanwhile. I'd be surprised what a German girl would do for a sea ration. Of course, I didn't do that, mind. And they eventually, I don't know how long it was we were in the camp, it wasn't very long. And of course the Germans were giving themselves up by the hundreds. And the Yanks had nowhere to put them. So they emptied our camp and put us in bell tents, just outside of, out of the original camp. And then they were locking all the Germans up in the our camp as they were coming in, disarming themselves. And they moved us up to Salzburg. And there we was, wasn't there long at Salzburg, and they said, right, get ready, we're moving you out tonight on the way home. And Salzburg Aerodrome, so they took us all down to Salzburg Aerodrome, and they put canteens up in the woods, and cinemas up in the woods. They knew how to do it, the Yanks did. And they split us up into 30, blocks of 30. And we were had to go down to the bottom of the runway, 30. And then a distance, 30, said, right the way up to the runway. But then the tannoy went and said that, sorry, you've got to spend the night in the woods, rough it. And said, don't worry, you know, we'll entertain you all night, and there'll be plenty of food, and there'll be blankets for you and everything. Because the atmospheric conditions had stopped the Dakotas from coming to fetch us. But you'll be on your way tomorrow morning. And at 7 o'clock the next morning, I've never seen anything like that in my life. We all paraded and in the blocks of 30. The sky was black with Dakotas. And they were coming in, well, just like a taxi service. They were coming in, landing, taxis down, 30 men on board. And this went on and on and on. Non-stop, just like a taxi service. And they took us to Reims in France. There they deloused us, fed us again. Kept us there about 3 days, I think it was.
Were you in a camp at Reims?
Yeah, well, in a kind of a camp. It was quite a nice place. It was buildings. And then the order come out that we was moving the next morning. I said to my mate, I said, I'm going to make sure of this. We'll sleep outside the gates. tonight. Inside the gates. So we're the first ones out. And we went out in the morning, and still pitch dark, onto the runway. And lined up there was Lancaster bombers. I don't know how many it was. We were blocked off so many to a Lancaster bomber. And as they loaded, they took off. And they dropped us somewhere in southern England, and I don't know where. I never did know where. There they deloused us again as we got off the plane. Took us into these hangars. There's a meal laid out, typical English meal, where we'd been living on fresh fruit and tinned fruit and God knows what. Was living off junk food in there, typical army junk food. And then we had to queue up at the door, and we got £3 pocket money. And taking in consideration that we hadn't had no money for, we'd got wages going back 6 years. Gave us £3. And they gave us new uniforms. And ribbons. And took us down to this camp. And it contained Italian prisoners. And all we had in our part of the camp was an old bed and two biscuits, no pillows, no sheets, no nothing. But the word went round that the Italians had got everything. They'd got pillowcases and sheets. So they broke the wire down and went in and tipped all the Italians out of bed, and they took all the bedding and brought it down into our camp. And me and Jack, my mate Jack from Gunnaby, we'd had enough really, because we didn't know what the future held for us. So we decided that we'd go on the run late at night, find out where the nearest railway station was, and we were going to jump a train anywhere to come to Leicester or Grantham or wherever it was, as long as it was coming up north. And we jumped a milk train, which dropped us at Leicester. Now we've got to get from Leicester to Grantham. So we jumped another train. Of course, the ticket collector was annoyed because we hadn't got no tickets. And we told him who it was, but he wasn't interested, so we had to give names to repay the ticket. But we gave them false names, any name under the sun, any address under the sun. And we got down to Grantham late at night. Now, I knew Grantham Station very well. But I knew that it was guarded by Redcaps police. And I knew they'd pick us up there. So it was a corridor train, so I said, come on, we'll go right down to the bottom, the last carriage. I said, because all other carriages can't get into the station platform. I said, as soon as the train stops, bail out, slide down the bank, I said, and onto the road at the bottom. And we're in Grantham. But what I didn't know, there was a 15-foot drop at the end of the bank. Mm. Damn it. But we made it. And he set off to walk to Gunnaby. I set off for the A1, but I came through Grantham. I was walking through Grantham, and I saw this transport cafe place. Mm. So I went in there, and the woman took one look at me and wondered who I was. And I had enough money for a cup of coffee, cocoa. She said, where do you come from? And I told her, at prison camp. She said, oh my God, she said, where are you going? I said, well, I want to get to South Witham, down the A1 to South Witham. She said, well, how are you going to get there? I said, I'm going to walk it. I said, I've done enough bloody walking in my prison of war time. I said, that ain't going to bother me. She said, I'll see what I can do for you. And she come back to me a bit later and she said, I've got you a lift. There was a furniture van coming down south. And they put me in the back of this old furniture van. And I said, stop at the Fox Inn. Do you know the Fox Inn? Mm-hmm. The hotel. I was born there, by the way. Mm-hmm. I said, don't forget to stop there, because that's where I want to get off. But I wanted to go south with them. It was only 2 miles across country. Which they did, they dropped me off about 3 o'clock in the morning, perhaps more. And I got a brother, a sister and a brother-in-law living in the little cottages there then. So I threw Grab up at the window and welcome home. Of course, as soon as they found out who I was, they didn't know where I was or what I was. They come tearing downstairs and let me in. Said, "Are you hungry?" I said, "I'm starving." I said, "What do you fancy?" I said, "You wouldn't have eggs and bacon, would you?" They said, "Yeah." I said, "Bacon, eggs and bacon."
Had you been able to keep in touch with your family while you've been...
No, not really. No. Well, I tell you, I got... Did I show you them letters?
No.
I got 75 letters there that I never received from the wife. Huh? They got returned to her. 75.
That's a lot.
Because they didn't know where I was. And, of course, when I knocked on the door at Southwitham, the wife wouldn't answer the door. She was in bed and she wouldn't answer the door. And I had a hell of a job to persuade her to wake up and find out who I was. Because someone expected me home then, you see. They was expecting me home in about a couple of days' time. They got all the banners out, welcome home, even balloons. But I beat them all to it. I come back at 3 o'clock in the morning. And when they were waiting at the bus stop to greet me, I was already in bed fast asleep. Yes, I got 75 letters there. The wife wrote to me and I never received. At the end of the war, they were all returned to her. Oh, well. Yeah. So I think that's about all, mate.
How were you demobilised eventually? Did you have to go through back to the army to get demobilised?
No, well, it was strange because the army had a system where they were going to rehabilitate us into the civilian life.
Yeah.
And I'd been on a couple of days and I had two officers appear. And they wanted to know my particulars and I said, you'll been allocated in a spot somewhere, I don't know where it was. Some camp. I said, what for? They said, to be rehabilitated. And I said, look, mate, I've done my time. I've rehabilitated myself. I had to rehabilitate myself as a prisoner of war. I can easily rehabilitate myself here at home with a wife. Oh, no, I've got to do it. I said, I'm not. I said, don't you dare try to arrest me and put me in one of them places. But they came several times. But I wouldn't go. I absolutely refused. Now, whether they'd have done me any good or not, I don't know, but I had to have psychiatric treatment later on. Because I was having terrific nightmares.
How much later was that?
Practically 2 years. I found out that I was waking up in the night. I was escaping, or if I wanted escaping, I was doing something. And I used to try to bail out the bedroom window.
So you're sleepwalking as well?
I said, yeah. I said, try to get the window open. So what I had to do, I screwed all the windows up, all the handles up, because there were these here iron windows.
Yes.
So I screwed them all up and secured them.
What happened in these nightmares then?
Everything. It's the past coming back. Escaping, ill treatment, fighting, starving, everything comes back. And there's one thing I had to do, and that was to find light. Tried sleeping with the light on. That didn't work. I had to get to the window. So one night, the wife grabbed me and hung on to me. And I struck her. And I thought, well, that's enough. I've got to get help now. So I went to see the doctor, and he put me under psychiatrist at Sleaford. The lunatic asylum at Sleaford.
What kind of treatment did they give you there?
Gas.
Gas?
Gas treatment, yeah. Terrible.
Did it work?
It worked.
How long did it take before you...
Three sessions.
Three sessions.